I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a very cool new app that also happens to be the sponsor of the next quarter of The Unmistakable Creative. It's called Oddvisor. And what Oddvisor allows you to do is listen to short 3-minute insights from experts across multiple fields. So just imagine it this way. Imagine if you could take your favorite 3-minute soundbite from a bunch of former Unmistakable Creative guests, string them all together in some sort of a playlist, and listen to them. Well, that's basically what Oddvisor is. It's kind of like Pandora, but for business. And former Unmistakable Creative guests like Seth Godin, Sally Hogshead, and Pamela Slim are already all on the platform. You can actually listen to some of their best wisdom. They're going to be adding more and more former Unmistakable Creative guests. It's a really, really cool app. You can learn more about it at oddvisor.com. The other thing that's awesome about Oddvisor is it's available not only for Apple devices, it's also available on Android devices. So again, learn more about it at oddvisor.com, or you can actually go and download it straight from the App Store on both iTunes or on Android. Okay, now let's get into what today's episode is about. In this episode of the podcast, I speak with Buddhist Geeks founder Vincent Horn, who discusses how to conduct a deep process of self-inquiry through mindfulness and meditation. Vincent, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah. So, you know, I came across you by way of, another podcast called Reboot.io, which to me is one of the real gems that I've discovered on the internet recently, especially because they talk about the emotional journey of entrepreneurship, something that I think, you know, we don't spend a lot of time talking about, or is kind of almost taboo to talk about, or has been for quite some time. But on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how that's brought you to where you're at and what you're up to in the world today?
Yeah, sure. I'll sort of temper how far back in the past I go here, but I'd say, you know, in terms of my work with Reboot and the reason I was on that show, it goes back to, I'd say, when I was 19 and a freshman at NC State University. I was a computer engineering student, and I joined the engineering department because I loved computers, and also because when I went to a little open house, they said, you know, engineers are making 55 grand a year on average. And I said, ooh, that'd be nice. So I joined the engineering department, and really during that first year or two, started going through a process of, I guess, in retrospect, I'd call it an existential crisis or a dark night of the soul, and went from wanting to become a successful engineer to dropping out and becoming a full-time meditator. Mm-hmm. And the basic thing that kind of got me out of the conventional path, I guess, which is probably pretty common for creatives of all sorts, is that I started having some unmistakable experiences of transcending my current experience of localized identity, like of a sense of being here, being this person named Vince with all of the sort of memories and stories that I have of just being that. I had an experience of several experiences of seeing and experiencing some vast reality that went beyond that. It included it, but it went beyond it at the same time, and it felt fundamentally true on some level. So you could say it was a hallucination, perhaps, but from my perspective, and for many who experience stuff like this, it feels like you're actually discovering something that was always true. And so that those experiences felt so compelling and so important to me that I dropped out of school to really try to find a path or a system that could help me deepen and stabilize those initial kind of glimpses that I'd had into this vast reality of wisdom and compassion that transcend the sort of personal story, the personal ego, the personal narrative, and yet somehow still include it. You know, that it's not like I disappeared completely. I just disappeared for a while, but I had to come back. So that's really what got on this sort of path of meditation, of exploring the mind. The Buddhist tradition was the one thing I could find that had a really clear, systematic kind of exploration of this territory. So I just went with it. And that led me to eventually going to Naropa University, which is in Boulder, Colorado. It's a Buddhist-inspired school. We call it the Harvard of Buddhist schools because, you know, it's one of the few that exists. So, of course, it's Ivy League. Mm-hmm. And I spent the next 3 years there kind of deepening that understanding, continuing my education. My wife really wanted me to get a degree, which I think in retrospect was smart. And it's there that I met a whole community of conscious entrepreneurs, of people on the fringe doing meditation, starting businesses, exploring creativity in various aspects. And it was really in Boulder that I found a kind of community of peers that I could kind of explore all these very interesting and weird converging areas of exploration. Mm-hmm. And so it was there that I got into a lot of other things that eventually led me to meeting Jerry, who's the host of the podcast you mentioned. And he ended up becoming a mentor and investor in the work that I've done with a project called Buddhist Geeks. And that sort of led me to eventually working with folks in more of a teaching or coaching capacity, of taking the years of meditation and training that I'd done and sort of supporting other people in their own process of waking up to some of these more kind of perennial truths about reality, and then learning how to apply those realizations to life as opposed to just kind of dropping out completely, which I think might be useful for a time, for a period of time when one gets into some of this stuff. But it's really, I think, the culmination of that is to bring it back. To bring it back into the world, to actually be transformed and then return in some new way to what one was doing. So that's kind of the journey I've been on, and it's also kind of an archetypal journey. It's not just my journey. Mm-hmm. So it's been a trip.
Hmm. So, you know, I want to go back to the very beginning and that moment when you hear that, you know, engineers are getting paid $55,000 a year. So you decide that, you know, hey, I'm going to study engineering. Because I had a moment that was extremely similar to that. I walked into Berkeley thinking, you know what, I love writing. I love creating things. I'm going to be an English major. And I remember there was a career fair on campus. I stopped by as a freshman, not realizing that nobody hires freshmen for summer internships at places like, you know, what is now Accenture. And a guy who was a recruiter there told me, yeah, he said, we don't really hire English majors. And from that point forward, every single decision I made about whatever course I took, whatever, anything that I studied, was all based on whether or not I thought it would do something for me from a career perspective. And the truth is, I did miserable in all of those classes, and none of them did anything for me from a career perspective.
Interesting.
So I'm really, you know, I'd be interested in kind of hearing your perspective on, you know, how you deal with moments in your life, or even, you know, if you're in something that you actually despise doing and somehow it still pays, or all that. I'm just really interested in hearing your perspective on all of this, based on that experience of having, you know, made the decision to say, you know what, screw this, I'm experiencing an existential crisis, and then I want to get into the crisis itself.
Yeah. You know, when you're describing that, the choice to kind of choose the more practical or the pragmatic, you know, avenue, I can relate to that. I think that was part of my desire to go into engineering. And then the other part was actually that I loved computers. So that helped. Mm-hmm. But, you know, later when I went through that crisis and I started questioning all of these things about life and what's important to me, suddenly that practical choice didn't make sense in the face of those other insights. And so I feel like, you know, for myself, I prioritize idealism. I prioritize my ideals and kind of my deepest aspirations above the practical. And fortunately, being, you know, in your early 20s, it's easier to do that, right, than it is later in life. And so at that time, I think that choice made sense. And I guess depending on who the person is and where they're at in their life, you know, that kind of extreme swing of the pendulum may or may not work for people, I imagine. But it does seem like we always have to contend with or work with these two poles of the practical, the pragmatic, and the idealistic, and the kind of the deep aspirational vision. And I suspect there's a place that those things meet. I like the term pragmatic idealism because it seems to kind of force those two together. But it also seems like that we move in a kind of pendulum swing or a spiral, mm-hmm. where sometimes we're like swinging in one direction or the other. I don't know if you ended up swinging from that practical approach toward a new direction, but I've certainly found that I swing.
Yeah, well, it took about 10 years to swing in the other direction, and I never swung back swing. The other way.
Yeah, exactly. A 10-year swing. And then here you are podcasting. It's great.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me is when I hear you talk about this existential crisis, it sounds like a process of self-inquiry. And the other thing you talked about is sort of transcending the identity of who you knew yourself to be. And the question I have is how we might, not in a way that's debilitating, but in a way that's actually transformative, bring about our own existential crisis and conduct a process of self-inquiry that allows us to transcend our sense of identity as we know it. Does that make sense? I realize that sounded really weird.
No, it makes perfect sense to me. I hope it made sense to the folks listening. And I'll try to answer it in a way that hopefully clarifies it if it was confusing. So how to actually do that in a way that is transformative and then also not debilitating. Mm-hmm. How to go into a process of deep self-inquiry, self-investigation, self-knowledge, as Socrates put it. There's a lot of ways to do it. And one of the reasons I gravitated to the meditative traditions is because they really have spent thousands of years developing some of those methodologies, those methods, mm-hmm. and some of the frameworks, the conceptual frameworks and the support networks that can be used to keep it from becoming debilitating or to keep you from going off the rails. Because a lot of people throughout history have gone off the rails when it comes to self-inquiry. Because in a way, this is really dangerous stuff.
I mean,
in a way, like you're playing with fire and the thing that you're burning away is your own identity. Mm-hmm. So if you do that wrong, or if you do it in a way that doesn't, you know, you don't have support or you have a really bad model for what you're doing, it actually can lead to things like paralytic depression, you know, being just completely paralyzed by depression. It can lead to, if you have a history of mental illness, it can actually exacerbate that. I'm getting all the warnings up front here. You know, it can actually lead to temporary periods of mental instability, of a lack of ability to function well in the world. It did for me at times, and I was even doing it with support. I was also doing a really heavy doses of meditation, you know, like months at a time of meditating all day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one way you can kind of control this is by not, you know, overdosing. but if you are able to work with, I think, a good container that can hold that process and you have good people around you who ideally have been through the process themselves or who know others that have, if you have good techniques that have been reality tested by many people, if you have all of that and you feel a draw to this, then, you know, I say starting with some basic meditation techniques of just being able to still the mind, of being able to calm down enough to be present for more than our eight second attention span, which by the way has gone down 4 seconds since 2000.
Wow.
We're now a second beneath goldfish in terms of our average attention span. But if you can first start to work on increasing that, I think that's a good place to start. And that doesn't have a lot of destabilizing effects either. Mm-hmm. That actually has a lot of real-world benefits, and of just being able to focus on whatever's in front of you and maintain that focus. That's the first step, I think, to develop that concentration, that stability of mind. And then, you know, if you imagine that concentration of mind, that stability is like a telescope that you've been polishing the lens of, you know, that then you can take that inner telescope and you begin to use it to investigate your experience. So that's the shift from concentration to then investigation or to mindfulness. And with that, once you start doing the mindfulness experiment of actually noticing what you notice as you notice it, noticing how your subjective reality is made up, how is it constructed? What is this self that we take ourselves to be? You know, is it a thought? Is it a feeling? Is it a body sensation? Is it a combination of those things? Is it something that exists outside of those categories? If you start to investigate and start to kind of pay attention, you know, moment by moment, what is arising in your experience right now, then that process is a lot like the scientific process of breaking things down into their component parts. You know, of a scientist, you imagine a scientist who's, you know, studying molecules, and they're breaking the molecules down and seeing, oh, those molecules are made of atoms, and they're bonded in these particular ways, and there are these particular rules that govern how that bonding happens and how these things work. In the same way, you can take your own well-refined attention and you can run these same experiments on your own conscious experience and see what the kind of the makeup of your consciousness is. And the reason that's useful is because we're so often struggle, I think, with a mistaken notion of who we are. And that mistaken notion is almost always too small for reality. It's like we think we're something really small. We think we're this small collection of thoughts and habits and behaviors that are kind of frozen in time. When the reality is those thoughts and behaviors and habits are present, but they're not frozen at all. They're completely fluid and open. And by noticing that fluidity and that openness, suddenly the self, actually our sense of self, can begin to expand, can begin to include more. And this is where the creativity part, I think, connects in with this process. Because the bigger we are, the more we can include, the more fluid and open our attention is and our awareness is, suddenly the more connections we can see, the more we can hold, the bigger our heart becomes, the stronger we can get behind the vision of our work, whatever that is. And that has a huge benefit in terms of being able to function. And it also comes with an increased sense of freedom, of not being caught or stuck on any particular experience or thought that tends to roll through our minds. It's like we don't get derailed by every thought about failure or about ourselves not being good enough. You know, those thoughts can come, they can be felt, they can be known, and then they can dissolve. And we can see that it's a story that we keep telling ourselves that isn't always present. And because it's not always present, it's not completely true. So that can be hugely liberating and freeing to start to see that, not just as an idea, but as an actually lived experience that you can kind of start to rely on more.
Okay, so there's a ton of stuff there. And you know, I'd imagine unpacking this we could probably spend a decade doing, but you know, the question I think that's going to come up for anybody, myself included, is how. You know, you talked about how, you know, living this experience, and you know, and I can tell you from my own attempts, I mean, I finally sat down with this app called Calm, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with. And managed to just sit still for 5 minutes a day, and yet I'm kind of like, okay, is this really benefiting me? And also, you brought up the whole idea of attention. I mean, you mentioned concentration, calm, investigation, and mindfulness. I'm wondering if you could give us a framework for carrying us through that process so that we could apply this on a day-to-day basis in some way that, in some way that's accessible to the average person who doesn't have, you know, the freedom to go and, you know, basically completely just bail out of society.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It totally. I mean, the bailing out of society, I mean, that's the crash course for the, you know, for the professional mind hacker. You know, that's the direction you want to go if that's like your life. But, you know, for most people, as you say, that's not going to be either one, doable, two, you know, desirable, or three, advisable for most folks.
Right.
So, yeah, so in terms of practical, you know, starting off with that, I think, like what you're describing of starting with at least a period every day where you can just stop and you can tune in to what's happening. And for me, I like to start real simply with the breath and the body as a place to anchor my attention, because the breath and the body are really simple. When you're aware of your body, you're not able to spin out in thoughts to get lost in the virtual reality of your own mind, because the body just holds your presence there. And then the breath is always happening. We're always breathing. We don't need to do anything to make it happen. It's just always there. It's the ultimate portable meditation device. So, what I would suggest as a way to start, just as a way to start experiment, would be to make 5, 10 minutes to just sit, to tune into your body. You can even do this a little now as you're listening, to let your attention drop into your body, to feel what's present. It's not all going to be pleasant. There might be some tension, some discomfort, but you can allow yourself to relax around that. And then you just feel your breath. Feel the breath breathe you. If it helps, you can feel it in your abdomen as the breath comes in and out, as it rises and falls. You can feel it in your chest as the chest rises and falls. Or you could even feel it at your nostrils as the cool breath comes in and then the warm breath comes out. So just finding a place to anchor your attention as you breathe. And then the basic instruction is, when your mind wanders, because it will, because we have only an 8-second attention span, when it wanders to thought, when it wanders to the past, remembering what happened, to the future, planning what's next, when you start feeling overwhelmed, just notice that it's happened, that you've lost the breath, that you've become entangled in these stories in the mind. And then when you notice you've wandered, simply return back to the body, back to the breath, and feel yourself breathe. Feel the sensations of breath, the expansion on the in-breath, the contraction on the out-breath, just riding that wave of breath, feeling it in your body, grounded. And if you just can do that for 5, 10 minutes regularly, then you'll start to notice your attention become more stable and become more flexible, just as doing something as simple as riding an awareness of the breath. That's really all it takes to start to see the initial benefits and the initial promise of mind training, of being able to train the mind.
Let's take a quick break and thank our friends at Odvisor, who are the sponsors for our next quarter of The Unmistakable Creative. At the beginning of the episode, I know I talked about the app, and what the app basically does is allow you to access sound bites from hundreds of experts in thousands of different areas. There's short sound bites on storytelling, on communication, on presentations, and it's like having access to former Unmistakable Creative guests in short sound bites on a playlist. So imagine being able to go through a playlist and have the best things you've ever heard on The Unmistakable Creative boiled down to 3 minutes. So definitely check out the app. And now let's get back to the show.
So what I'm really interested in is actually sort of the byproducts of this, in sort of real world practical application, like how, especially, considering where I discovered you, which was on a podcast about the emotional journey of entrepreneurship. I mean, how does it how does all this help us navigate the emotional journeys of our lives and our work?
Yeah, so the first thing that I found, and I think many other people find when they do this, is that when your mind is a little more stable, a little more quiet, a little more still, which it may be after you just ran that experiment, one thing is you're more sensitive, right? You're more aware of what's happening in your experience. You're more attuned to what's arising. So you're more attuned to your body. You're also more attuned to your emotional world, to what's actually being felt. And you're more attuned to your thinking process, your thoughts. And so that awareness, first and foremost, and that sensitivity gives us the space to work with what's there, to actually see it. And by seeing it, we're no longer run by it. So that's the first key thing. By being aware of it, we're no longer run by it. So we can begin to notice what's happening and begin to work with it in a skillful way. We can make a little more space for what we're feeling instead of just kind of rushing to the next thing or wanting to get away from what's being felt. And by doing that, we can let our emotional lives flow more freely through us. And when we do that, we become much more flexible emotionally. We become much more easeful with what's coming up, even if what's coming up is anger or frustration or sadness or grief. You know, even when it sucks, we have a little bit more capacity to ride those waves of difficulty. And so I think, you know, what I've noticed is an increase in resiliency and being able to deal with the ups and downs of life. And those ups and downs of life are not limited to, you know, sitting and meditating, or limited to those periods when we're, you know, noticing what's happening. They're happening all the time. They're happening in our relationships, in our conversations. They're happening in our work life for sure. And so those capacities can be applied and do get applied to all areas of our life, because we always have a mind, we always have a heart, we always are aware. And so they naturally start to infuse and kind of permeate our existence, actually.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So can you give us some things you've seen in other people's lives, you know, some specific examples of how you've seen this change people, especially in the world of entrepreneurship or creativity, you know, and seen people change for the better because of this?
Yeah, I mean, some of the work that I do with Reboot is in what's called the CEO Boot Camp, and that's like a 5-day, almost you could think of it like an immersive or intensive or retreat. And I've definitely seen those periods, you know, it's a collection of CEOs working at different tech startups coming together. We're doing meditation. We're sort of exploring, doing self-inquiry processes. We're talking about the challenges and hardships of being an entrepreneur and being in particular, a founder, a CEO. And what I've seen from that group of folks is really a kind of shift toward reprioritizing the being aspect of life, and making it a higher priority, even on par with the doing aspect of, like, constantly, you know, making things happen, executing and doing, which is, you know, extremely important if you're an entrepreneur or creative. Mm-hmm. Without that, you're not creating anything. But there's this other dimension of our being that we start to get in touch with. I mean, there's a reason we're called human beings, instead of, you know, humans going around and doing stuff all the time. It's because there is this deeper kind of aspect of ourselves that doesn't require us to do anything to be okay. Mm-hmm. And everyone's felt this. Like, this is not some esoteric thing. This is just like what it's like when you're sitting there watching a sunset and you're just okay. It's, you know, it's those moments where everything is just okay as it is. And what I've noticed is with that group of CEOs of really making more space for that, more time for that in their lives, prioritizing being, it seems to have the effect of first just relaxing them in an overall way, so that there's more space and more ease in their minds and in their lives. And what I've noticed from that is that then there's a greater perspective. They seem to have a little bit more of a vaster perspective on what they're doing, because they're not so caught in the doing. It's like they can take a step back from the doing and rest in being and notice doing, mm-hmm. and see doing. And I've really noticed a kind of widening of openness in people's minds that do that. And I think I can't point to very specific examples of ways that's changed someone's like business strategy, for instance, because again, it's sort of happening in the background.
Right.
It's hard to point to exactly, because it's kind of something that changes every aspect of your life. But overall, what I've noticed is a kind of a little more of a spacious type of thinking and a spacious type of holding things,
mm-hmm.
that ends up having these very, sometimes very tangible and sometimes very intangible impacts on life.
Hmm. You know, maybe the most interesting thing that I caught from what you just said was this whole idea of space.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the reason it caught my attention is that I was just writing about it this morning. I realize like events in our lives, the things that we don't want, our losses, our challenges, our difficulties, I mean, even sometimes the good things create space. And often we clutter that space.
Yes.
Things that are not good, or we clutter, you know, the future with the past.
Yes. Yes.
And I've noticed if I'm willing to just let the space be, a lot of things start to take care of themselves.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Yeah.
And I have to remind myself of that, because I there was a period in my life, probably mid 2013, where a lot of things started going wrong. But for the first time ever, I said, you know what? Let's just see what happens. I'm not going to fight this. And then things started going right in a way that they never had.
That's interesting. Yep. Yep. Yeah. I think what you're describing, it's so clearly related to what we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
and it makes sense what you're saying. And I found the same thing. When I make space for things, even when it's difficult, and even when I want to rush in and fill the vacuum, then things do seem to work out better than when I rush in and try to figure everything out and feel like I have to have the answers.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious, you know, in your experience, if this was true, because I think it is for a lot of people, it's that the tendency to want to fill that void, to want to clutter the space, it has something to do often with feeling uncomfortable with the space, feeling uncomfortable actually with not knowing what to do,
mm-hmm.
And wanting to get rid of that discomfort, wanting to avoid the discomfort. And it's like, you know, when we watch TV to distract ourselves, it's the same kind of thing. Like, we don't want to just be there and be bored or have to deal with our own minds. We want there to be something to fill that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that discomfort drives us into, you know, taking a rash action or not creating enough space for things to start to organize themselves.
Yeah.
Or to reorganize themselves, you know, in us or something. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Can you relate to the discomfort part?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, it's part of it is I think that there's a narrative, I think culturally, that also plays out. It's like, you know, get to work and do something and hustle. And
yes.
If you're not, you're just being lazy and incompetent and wasting time. And, you know, and I think that that's, it's funny because I think to some degree that also hurts us.
Oh, I think so too. I mean, I actually think that societal cultural belief structure that you're describing, it's the way that we've sort of institutionalized our aversion to discomfort, our aversion to being.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually one of the ways we shut ourselves off from the deeper wisdom that we have access to, and make it culturally sanctioned to do that. So I think it's actually a huge problem, what you're describing.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, given the company that you keep and the people that you're around, I mean, you know, tech startup CEOs, I mean, I think of all places you see this coming from Silicon Valley. I mean, all you have to do is browse through Medium every day and look at kind of the, you know, hustle, go for it, bust your ass sort of motivational stuff that shows up there.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, some of it is inspiring, and other times I feel like the laziest person in the world because I'm not doing any of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet what you described is when you let yourself be lazy, or you let yourself have space. Mm-hmm. Then you started doing things. Suddenly things came together in a way that probably no amount of hustle would have enabled, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you basically are just fighting an uphill battle when you're doing that.
Yeah.
So, well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. And let's talk about, you know, what Buddhist Geeks is, where it came from, you know, what it's all about today. And I'd love to hear more about that story.
Yeah, so Buddhist Geeks, it started actually when I went to Naropa University. I was, I transferred there, and I was actually in my last semester there, and I'd met a close friend who had background as an audio engineer. And then so he had the kind of audio geeky skills, and I had this sort of background in computer engineering and also web design that I'd continued to kind of stay interested in and work on. So we ended up with a few things coming together: an interest in Buddhist practice, in technology, in contemporary culture. We both were at the time in our, you know, early mid 20s, so we were really interested in the way that Buddhism as a tradition was changing in the 21st century, you know, in light of the internet and the information revolution that we've been going through. And we had the tech skills enough to pull off a podcast. So we were sitting and complaining actually one day at a coffee shop about how we were frustrated with the you know, some of the older people in the Buddhist world and how they weren't, you know, covering certain things and how they weren't, you know, kind of shutting down certain perspectives because it didn't kind of fit with their models. And instead of complaining, we decided to actually start this podcast and this series of interviews where we could actually give voice to some of those things, and we could invite some of those people to share their perspectives, and we could explore some of the topics that we thought weren't getting really great coverage. So fortunately, we took that, you know, disappointment and turned it into a constructive avenue. And, you know, we really didn't expect much to happen. This was 2006, 2007. Podcasting really was just starting to get going, and we had some podcasts we loved, like This Week in Tech, but there wasn't a whole lot out there yet. We didn't know how many people were listening. So we expected this to be like one of our many hobby projects that kind of like was exciting in the beginning and then fizzled out. But it ended up being something that people responded to really quickly and with a lot of interest. And so we felt the sort of responsibility to continue it. And so that's kind of how Buddhist Geek started, just as a kind of, again, an experiment that we ran and that people responded to. And over the years, it's gone from being a podcast show, which was, you know, very much a hobby project for both of us, to becoming my full-time job in 2010. When I took over the project and started to do some crowdfunding and also organize our first in-person event, which was a conference we held in Los Angeles in 2011. And for some reason, I think this might have something to do with the whole analog and digital worlds colliding. Mm-hmm. We found that as soon as we held something in person, like an actual event, that suddenly the rest of the, you know, the rest of the world kind of became aware of us that hadn't before. Like suddenly we were, you know, articles were being written up about Buddhist Geeks and, you know, publications and things like that that had never happened before. And so that kind of took things to another level. And suddenly some of the stuff we'd been exploring for years suddenly became interesting on a more of a kind of mainstream cultural level, like, you know, what's the relationship between training the mind and technology? You know, is technology the cause of all of our problems, as many people argue? Is it the thing that's causing our attention span to go down from 12 to 8 seconds? Or is technology something that could actually be utilized and designed in ways that support well-being and focus and calm and clarity? Mm-hmm. And so those were things we were exploring for many years, as well as a whole host of other kind of geeky stuff. But, you know, it was really at that point that it became more of a mainstream conversation. And, you know, from there, it's really become also a community of practice. You know, we've started doing a lot of events that are more focused on practice, on meditating together. And we call it our Sangha in the Cloud. And Sangha is a sort of Buddhist term for a community of people who are practicing together, who have like a shared aim. So that's kind of been the focus lately, and it's been great fun. And at the same time, What I'm seeing more and more is that it's necessary to step outside of the Buddhist context and the Buddhist framework to offer things more broadly to people that may not have an interest in learning that whole system, or who may have a kind of allergic reaction to any kind of ideological system. Although what's interesting about that is pretty much everything, from what I can tell, is an ideological system. So it's hard to avoid that. But I understand why people have allergies to religion and why they have felt burned in the past by really closed-minded systems that can't see that they have limitations and that they aren't the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So, you know, lately my focus has been much more on that aspect of things, of like how to take what I've learned from these really amazing traditions of practice and translate them in ways that really resonate with people that are living in contemporary society, so that it's not necessary to be a Buddhist in order to have a mind that's trained and a heart that is open. I don't think it's necessary at all. In fact, the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. You know, that's sort of an idea that came later. He's just a person trying to figure some stuff out about his human experience. You know, that's kind of been the direction lately, and it feels like a natural unfolding from the Buddhist Geeks project. It's like, okay, the culmination of that is to kind of, again, take what's been learned and offer, and hopefully have something to offer back. We'll see.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that when I look at projects on the internet, especially hobby projects, the ones that are really, really successful always seem to be ones that sort of grow organically. They're never from the people who have followed some step-by-step formula to try and manufacture a result, which is funny because I think that takes us right back into that conversation of creating space.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it ties back to what we were talking about before about, you know, what is it that motivates us to do things? Is it kind of practicality and just trying to kind of make ends meet purely? Or is it a kind of pure idealism, which, you know, often is hard to execute on and we end up just kind of being lost in our thoughts about how reality should be? Or is it some way in which we can kind of bring those energies together and like follow a vision and be inspired by something, make space, like you're saying, for something to emerge? Because I think what space is so interesting for and why it's so important is because if we have space, something can emerge in that space. And it can even be something that we wouldn't expect. And if we can make room for that in our creative process, I do have a feeling that the stuff that is most interesting, like you're saying, is the stuff that emerges from whence we don't know. We don't know where it comes from. It's some combination of our own passions and skills aligning with some social interest and, you know, some like kind of cultural interest aligning with, you know, and then something novel emerges that knocks us back even as the creatives. We go, whoa, you know, we can't even really take credit for it completely because it's not something that we conceived of by ourselves. It's something that emerged from this really complex set of conditions, and that we made space for somehow.
Well, Vincent, this has been really, really fascinating, and I'm really glad we got a chance to have you on the show. So I want to close with one final question. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, wow. You know, when I think of unmistakable, I think of something that really stands out. And I think of ideas and ways of being that really shock the foundations or the cores of what we think we know. So I, you know, taking that, I think what makes someone unmistakable is when they've really dived in to their own process and their own journey, and they've come out the other side with whatever that is, having been completely transformed and having kind of glimpsed a vision for how things might be that are different than how they are now, and that they actually align themselves with that vision and try to bring it into their lives, you know, through what they do, through their work, through their way of being, through how they relate, you know, that they become an embodiment of that vision. That to me is something that strikes me as unmistakable. It's like when I see that, I know it, you know. I don't always like it and I don't always agree with them, but I can tell there's something there, you know, that's just profound.
Well, I think that makes a beautiful way to wrap up our conversation. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your story and your insights with our listeners. This has been fantastic.
Cool. Thank you so much. It's awesome to join you in this.
Yeah. And for those of you listening, we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.